From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
We discovered the extent of Khan's hidden network. We tagged the proliferators. We detected the network stretching across four continents, offering its wares to countries like North Korea and Iran.
CIA Director George Tenet, 2 years ago, he said the nuclear arms smuggling ring of Pakistani scientist AQ Khan had been taken down. So did President Bush.
Governments around the world work closely with us to unravel the Khan network and to put an end to its criminal enterprise. AQ Khan has confessed his crimes, and his top associates are out of business.
So why is the U.S. ignoring requests from Swiss officials to hand over information that would help prosecute alleged members of AQ Khan's underground network? We'll speak with a Pakistani physicist. Then former U.N. weapons inspector Hans Blix calls for a permanent worldwide ban on nuclear, chemical and biological weapons. And we'll look at how one of New York City's biggest landlords is systematically driving thousands of low-income residents from their homes and gentrifying whole neighborhoods. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The number of casualties from last weekend's earthquake in Indonesia has risen to more than 6,200. The number of injured has doubled to some 46,000 people, with three-quarters of them suffering serious injuries. More than 139,000 homes were destroyed or damaged in the earthquake. New evidence has emerged in the case of another alleged massacre of Iraqi civilians at the hands of U.S. troops. The BBC has obtained video footage bolstering accusations first made by Iraqi police that U.S. troops murdered 11 civilians in the town of Ishaqi in March. The dead included five children and four women and ranged in age from 6 months to 75 years old. The Pentagon has insisted only four civilians died in the attack and that they were killed when their home collapsed during a gun battle. But according to the BBC, the new video shows a number of dead adults and children with visible gunshot wounds. Democracy Now! Covered this story in March. We spoke with Knight Ridder reporter Matthew Schofield in Baghdad. He first obtained the Iraqi police report that accused U.S. troops of the civilian killings.
We were talking with the police officer who was first on the scene earlier today. He explained the scene of arriving. He said they waited until U.S. troops had left the area and it was safe to go in. When they arrived at the house, it was in rubble. I don't know if you've seen the photos of the remains of the house, but there was very little standing. He said they expected to find bodies under the rubble. Instead, what they found was in one room of the house, in one corner of one room, there was a single man who had been shot in the head. On the directly across the room from him, against the other wall, were 10 people, ranging from his 75-year-old mother-in-law to a six-month-old child, also several three-year-olds, a couple three-year-olds, a couple five-year-olds, and three other women. Lined up, they were covered in bullets. They had all been shot. According to the doctor we talked to today, they'd all been shot in the head, in the chest, some of them were shot several times. The doctor said it's very difficult to determine exactly what kind of caliber gun they were shot with. So the entry wounds are generally small and round. The exit wounds are generally very large. But they were lined up along one wall. There was a blanket over the top of them, and they were under the rubble. So when the police arrived and residents came to help them start digging in, they came across the blanket. They came across the blankets. They picked the blankets up. They say at that point that the hands were handcuffed in front of the Iraqis. They've been handcuffed and shot.
Matthew Schofield of Knight Ridder speaking to us in Baghdad in March. The latest evidence that a massacre occurred in Ishaqi comes as the U.S. government continues to deal with the uproar over the killings of at least 24 unarmed Iraqis in the town of Haditha. The Army announced Thursday troops will now undergo 30 days of mandatory ethics training. Meanwhile, in Baghdad, senior Iraqi officials called on the U.S. to apologize and hand over files related to the massacre. The Iraqi government wants the files for its own investigation. In another case, seven Marines are being held in the brig at Camp Pendleton. A defense attorney has disclosed the Marines are expected to be charged with murder, kidnapping, and conspiracy in the shooting death of an Iraqi man in the town of Hammamdia in April. A member of the Navy will also be charged. The victim was reportedly dragged from his home before he was shot to death. Media reports have speculated troops planted a gun near his body to make it appear he was an insurgent. Meanwhile, Iraq's prime minister has lashed out at the U.S. military over what he has called the daily phenomenon of U.S. attacks on Iraqi civilians. In an interview with the New York Times, Nouri Kamal al-Maliki said many troops do not respect the Iraqi people. Maliki went on to say, quote, they crush them with their vehicles and kill them just on suspicion. This is completely unacceptable, he said. And in other Iraq news, an army dog handler who served at Abu Ghraib was convicted Thursday of using his animal to torment a prisoner. Sergeant Santos Cordona is the 11th soldier to be convicted for the torture of detainees at Abu Ghraib. All but one of the 11 convictions has gone to a low-ranking soldier. This news on Iran. Six world powers, including the United States, have agreed on the terms of an offer to halt Iran's nuclear activities. On Thursday, the countries announced they would put aside punitive action and offer several incentives if Iran agrees to suspend nuclear production. Iran has stressed it'll enter into talks but will not agree to preconditions on negotiation. Several analysts say Iran's stance is unlikely to change without explicit security guarantees from the Bush administration. In Chile, the head of the Santiago Police Special Forces has been fired for his unit's treatment of student protesters during the past week. Scores of students were beaten, tear-gassed, and arrested as they took part in a countrywide walkout to demand more spending on education. The protest drew hundreds of thousands of people, making them the largest demonstrations Chile has seen in decades. Chilean President Michelle Bachelet said her government will listen to the protesters.
What we have seen are youngsters 16, 17 years old, youngsters that express what is democracy in our country. They are youngsters who are as old as our democracy, youngsters that are aware of their rights and are making demands, and what the government should do is listen to those demands and decide which of those demands are viable or not with transparency and seriousness.
Chilean President Michelle Bachelet. In Peru, voters will head to the polls this weekend to elect their new president. The race pits former President Alan Garcia against the retired army officer Ollanta Humala. Garcia is leading in the polls despite holding a 61% disapproval rating among voters. Humala led first-round voting in April. He has attracted wide support among Peru's rural poor for his calls to nationalize Peru's natural resources, tax foreign mining companies, veto a trade agreement with Washington, and end U.S.-sponsored eradication of coca. Humala wrapped up his campaign Wednesday in the capital of Lima.
Nosotros somos países pobres.
We are poor countries. Bolivia is just as poor as us, as Ecuador, Colombia, Venezuela. We are all underdeveloped and we need to seek integration. Alone we are worthless. We need integration in Latin America.
Necesitamos buscar la integración latinoamericana.
That was Peruvian presidential candidate Ollanta Humala. Here in the United States, Ray Nagin was sworn in Thursday for his second term as mayor of New Orleans. At the ceremony, Nagin addressed his supporters.
That's why I'm not worried about anything. I'm at peace. I know what you can do, and I know what you're getting ready to do. New Orleans, we once again have an opportunity like no other city in the country to rebuild, to restore, and to start anew. Katrina is our testimony. Rebuilding is our faith in action.
The ceremony came on the first official day of the hurricane season. Weather experts predict New Orleans will be the city most likely to be hit by a major storm this year. In other news from New Orleans, the Army Corps of Engineers has released a new report that blames its own failure in building New Orleans levees for the breaches that flooded the city during Hurricane Katrina. In a 9-volume, 6,000-page report, the Army Corps concludes, quote, the hurricane protection system in New Orleans and southeast Louisiana was a system in name only. In Ohio, a former Republican fundraiser has pleaded guilty to illegally funneling thousands of dollars into the campaign to re-elect President Bush. On Thursday, Tom Noe admitted he used several conduits, including Ohio politicians and former aides to Governor Bob Taft, to funnel around $45,000 to the president's campaign. At the time of his indictment, Noe's case was described as the largest campaign money laundering scheme since new campaign finance laws were enacted in 2002. Noe was named a pioneer by Bush's campaign for raising over $100,000. The U.S. government has asked internet service providers to keep the records of the web surfing activities of their customers. The government says the records would be used solely for efforts against terrorism and child pornography. FBI Director Robert Mueller and Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez reportedly made the request at a meeting with a group of senior executives representing the country's major online firms. Executives who attended the meeting told the New York Times they were also asked to retain records about whom their customers exchange emails with, but not the contents of the email messages. And finally, a port in Olympia, Washington, was the site of a major anti-war protest this week against a U.S. naval ship bound for Iraq. On Wednesday, the U.S. ship Pomeroy left the port of Olympia after a week of protests that drew hundreds of people and led to more than three dozen arrests. On Thursday, we spoke with Brendan Dunn of Students for a Democratic Society, who took part in the protests.
I was the first person arrested for nonviolent direct action out of over 40 arrests since the action started on May 22nd. We are protesting because we do not want our city, or any town or city for that matter, to be used for exporting death, destruction, and war. We want the occupation of Iraq to end and encourage soldiers to resist. In response to our nonviolent direct action, throughout the week, the police used excessive amounts of pepper spray, dragged people on the ground, and beat people with batons, all without warning. Many people were seriously injured. True, the ship is gone, but the war in Iraq is still waging.
That was Brendan Dunn of Students for a Democratic Society speaking from Olympia, Washington. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers. The Bush administration is being accused of refusing to help out Switzerland's federal prosecutor try three men at the center of the world's most notorious nuclear arms smuggling ring. The case involves a Swiss man and his two sons who were allegedly connected to the Pakistani scientist Abdul Qadir Khan, better known as AQ Khan. Khan, who is currently under house arrest in Pakistan, helped build Pakistan's nuclear weapons program and then secretly shared the technology with other countries, including Iran, North Korea, and Libya. 2 years ago, President Bush praised the international community for working together to disrupt Khan's network.
Governments around the world work closely with us to unravel the Khan network and to put an end to its criminal enterprise. AQ Khan has confessed his crimes, and his top associates are out of business.
But behind the scenes, it is a different story. Over the past year, Swiss officials have requested at least four times that the Bush administration share documents and evidence related to Khan's nuclear black market. But the United States has never responded. Swiss officials maintain they need U.S. assistance in order to convict three Swiss men accused of helping AQ Khan to set up a secret Malaysian factory to make components for gas centrifuges.
Last week, U.S. weapons expert David Albright testified before Congress and said, quote, "I find this lack of cooperation, frankly, embarrassing to the United States and to those of us who believe that the United States should take the lead in bringing members of the Khan network to justice for arming our enemies with nuclear weapons." Albright has floated one theory as to why the Bush administration won't help the Swiss investigators. He says the three Swiss men accused of being a part of AQ Khan's underground network may have been working for the CIA and being paid by the U.S. government. The CIA has refused to comment on the allegation, but former CIA Director George Tenet acknowledged the agency had penetrated Khan's network during a speech at Georgetown University in February of 2004.
Now, as you know from the news coming out of Pakistan, Khan and his network have been dealt a crushing blow, and several of his senior officers are in custody. Malaysian authorities have shut down one of the network's largest plants. His network is now answering to the world for years of nuclear profiteering. What did intelligence have to do with this? First, We discovered the extent of Khan's hidden network. We tagged the proliferators. We detected the network stretching across four continents, offering its wares to countries like North Korea and Iran. Working with our British colleagues, we pieced together the picture of the network, revealing its subsidiaries, its scientists, its front companies, its agents, its finances, and manufacturing plants on three continents. Our spies penetrated the network through a series of daring operations over several years. Through this unrelenting effort, we confirmed the network was delivering such things as illicit uranium enrichment centrifuges. And as you heard me say in the Libya case, we stopped deliveries of prohibited material. I welcome the President's Commission on Proliferation. We have a record and a story to tell, and we want to tell it to those willing to listen.
Former CIA Director George Tenet, speaking in February of 2004. We're joined right now by three guests. We'll start on the phone from Bern, Switzerland, with Hans-Jörg Mark Widmer. He's a spokesperson for the Swiss Attorney General. We welcome you to Democracy Now! Are you with us?
I am with us. Are you hearing me?
Yes, we can hear you fine. Can you explain what it is that you've requested of the United States and who the men are that you're prosecuting in Switzerland?
Well, first of all, we never give information or disclose information about people involved in our criminal investigations, but I can confirm that the Office of the Swiss Attorney General is leading a criminal investigation into any Swiss connection to nuclear proliferation plans in linked to the Khan network.
Now, Switzerland does have an agreement with the United States to cooperate in criminal investigations, does it not?
There is a contract between Switzerland and the United States regarding the cooperation within criminal cases like that. Also, after 9/11, the terrorist attacks of 9/11, the cooperation between Swiss and U.S. officials have been strengthened. So we are really confident that the U.S. authorities will provide us with the information we ask them, because it's in the best interest, not only for Switzerland, but for the United States as well, that this criminal investigation can go on into the clarification of the Swiss link to the whole question of the international question or international prosecution also of the Khan network.
But the reports are indicating that up until now, the United States has not responded to your request. Is that unusual, or is that a cause of concern for you?
No, actually, you know, the cooperation within the legal framework of international judicial assistance always takes time. We understand that, and we are also confident that the information that we need will be provided. I think that in the fight against international fight against nuclear proliferation, international cooperation on the level of law enforcement and judicial assistance is necessary. It's one of the things authorities and government can do to cooperate better, to clarify these things. We are aware of the fact that nuclear proliferation, also linked to international terrorism, is one of the big challenges for prosecution and law enforcement in the 21st century. Switzerland is playing its part. We are looking in our criminal investigation into any links to Switzerland or from Switzerland in this international problem, and we are confident that the cooperation with U.S. authorities will go on in that matter.
Hans-Jörg Mark Widmer with a spokesperson for the Swiss Attorney General. When we come back from our 60-second break, we will also be joined by David Albright, the former U.N. weapons inspector who testified before Congress last week, talking about why perhaps the U.S. government is not handing information over to the Swiss government to prosecute alleged members of the Khan network. We'll also speak with a Pakistani-born physicist from Princeton University, Zia Min, about AQ Khan. Stay with us.
Let's say goodbye with a smile, dear, just for a while, dear, we must part. Don't let this parting upset you, I'll not forget you, sweetheart. We'll meet again, don't know where. Don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Keep smiling through, just like you always do, till the blue skies chase those dark clouds far away.
Vera Lynn here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Our guests on the phone are Hans-Jürg Mark Widmer, spokesperson for the Swiss Attorney General, and David Albright joins us now, former U.N. weapons inspector. David Albright, you testified before Congress. Can you talk about what you said about this Swiss case and the U.S. government participation or non-cooperation?
Well, the thrust of the testimony was really just to point out that the Swiss government has been making requests for over a year for cooperation from the United States, and I helped them prepare a request to the State Department, a very senior official who was very much involved in this case, Robert Joseph, who's undersecretary. And so far, the U.S. government hasn't even acknowledged the receipt of these requests. And I know when I made some calls over the last couple months, my phone calls weren't returned. And so I think there's a problem that, frankly, I don't understand. The Swiss have gone to great lengths to narrow their requests because certainly the U.S. had concerns. Would this information reveal associations between some of the Tinners and our CIA? Because the Tinners did help the CIA in what I'd call the end game. I think the Tinners saw the writing on the wall. So you worry, will those associations be revealed? Another problem, would the Swiss see classified nuclear information involving gas centrifuges? And so in the requests, at least that I participated in, there was no request for information about intelligence matters. There was care taken to make sure that what the Swiss are asking to see at one of our national laboratories, namely Oak Ridge, is unclassified. The information, they want some documents, that those documents would be unclassified. And so the Swiss have bent over backwards to try to narrow their requests to respect the need for the United States to keep certain information secret. And there's been no response. And it's just, frankly, mystifying. And I think it's complicating the Swiss investigation. I find it embarrassing as an American that's, given the stature and the importance this president has put upon crushing the AQCon network and prosecuting the members of that network, that they simply don't even have the courtesy to give the Swiss any response at all.
You testified, David Albright, before Congress, saying, "I find this lack of cooperation, frankly, embarrassing to the United States and those of us who believe the United States should take the lead in bringing members of the Khan's network to justice for arming our enemies with nuclear weapons." You talk about the Tinners. They're a father and two sons, is that right?
Yes, that's right.
And what more do you know about them?
Well, one is that they were very key members of the network, and what they've been accused of doing is providing centrifuge parts to the network. Urs Tinner organized the creation of basically industrial capability in Malaysia to make centrifuge parts for the Libyan program. They were very high-ranking members of this network, years of operation with the network, and they're accused of violating laws, providing basically wherewithal to make nuclear weapons to a terrorist state, namely Libya. And so they're very serious charges. And they are not cooperating with the prosecutors, which is another dimension to this. You'd think if they, for example, We know that they did, as I mentioned, they worked with the CIA, but they weren't heroes. And I asked the State Department official, you know, were they key in uncovering the information or revealing the information that led to this interception of this ship, the BBC China, in October of 2003, which was a key, sort of the first step in really rolling up this network after years of having it under surveillance. And the State Department official said no. Actually, he smiled, laughed about it. And so I don't think the Tinners were heroes in this at all. And I found in investigating the illicit nuclear trade that often these traders, smugglers, will actually cooperate with intelligence services because they know they're under surveillance. And they'll give information about their colleagues. They'll try to protect themselves. And so my understanding is the Tinners did some valuable service for our intelligence service and also for the International Atomic Energy Agency, but it by no means is sufficient to get them an immunity from prosecution. And in essence, what the U.S. government is the signal it's sending is that it doesn't want the Swiss to prosecute these three people, and yet they provide no reason for that. And as the prosecutors investigate that, I investigated, the Tinners don't seem to warrant an immunity from prosecution.
Well, David Albright, given the boasting that has gone on both by President Bush and former CIA Director Tenet about the breakup of this network, how many people have actually been convicted of participating in this network and sent to jail?
Well, so far, very few. I mean, there's a Dutch person, Henk Slabos, who was sentenced to less than a year. It's kind of a slap on the hand. There's some people the Tinners are in jail. They haven't been charged yet. I mean, they're being investigated, and recommendations on charging them will probably be made in June or July. There's a whole group of people that were held in Pakistan. The last person was released last month. He'd been held for a couple of years. Khan's under house arrest. Sort of the CEO of the operation, Mr. Tahir, is under house arrest in Malaysia. There's a couple of people charged in South Africa who are out on bail, and their case will happen probably early next year.
So only one person has served any prison time at this point.
Other than these people who are under house arrest or were held without charges. So, it's not as bleak as what you just said. I mean, but it's not as good as it should be. And in fact, one of the problems is that in these kind of transnational organized crime networks, we're dealing with national criminal prosecutions, and they're suffering because they are national, and they haven't figured out how to really have, in a sense, get these guys when you need information from another country. I mean, this is a problem plaguing all these cases, and the way to bridge that problem is cooperation, active cooperation, and the system that's been set up is, you know, the Swiss prosecute the Swiss, the Germans prosecute the Germans, the South Africans prosecute the South Africans, or the people who live there for a long time. But vital is cooperation, and the U.S. is violating that. I mean, in the case of the Swiss, I mean, it's critical that countries cooperate to overcome these problems inherent in these national prosecutions, and I find it disturbing and perplexing that the United States will not provide the cooperation to the Swiss that they've requested.
We're talking to David Albright, former U.N. weapons inspector. We're going to go back to Hans-Jürg Mark Wiedmer in Switzerland, spokesperson for the Swiss Attorney General. But first, I want to bring in Professor Zia Min, Pakistani-born nuclear physicist at Princeton University. This discussion of who A.Q. Khan is, the man who is now under house arrest in his multi-million-dollar mansion in Pakistan, talk about this network. Talk about the man in the middle.
Well, A.Q. Khan has been a central player in the Pakistani nuclear program for the better part of three decades now. And I think that what we're seeing with the network and the court cases is the kind of logical unfolding of how Pakistan acquired its nuclear weapons, which was by buying components and skills from abroad, starting in the early 1970s, and once it succeeded, to turn that network around and start exporting material. But I think that the fact that AQ Khan is sitting in a mansion in Islamabad should have come as no surprise to anyone. I mean, he's been closely tied to every Pakistani government since he became involved in Pakistan's nuclear program, and has been treated and projected as a national hero. So there wasn't much that the government was going to do to somebody that they had built up like that.
Can you talk, Professor Meehan, about his relationship with the Pakistani government?
Well, AQ Khan has had a relationship with the leaders of Pakistan from the very beginning of his role. He was close to the founder of the Pakistani nuclear program politically, Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, the father of previous Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto. He's been close to all the generals that have actually had day-to-day control over Pakistan's nuclear program ever since it was started. And so, you know, he certainly, in the chain of command, his bosses were the chiefs of the Pakistan army, and less so the Pakistani political leadership, because the military are the real power brokers in Pakistan, even when we have civilian governments. And so that was who he reported to, and that was the people who told him what to do.
And in terms of the extent of his responsibility for proliferation of nuclear technology to other countries around the world?
In terms of proliferation, I mean, one has to understand that what AQ Khan did through his network in sharing nuclear centrifuge technology and other things, including the design of a nuclear weapon with Libya and Iran and North Korea, and you know, he may have tried to sell it to several other countries also, is not new in the scheme of things as far as proliferation goes. It's almost now axiomatic that countries that acquire nuclear weapons use those capabilities to strengthen and build strategic relationships. The United States helped Britain and France with their nuclear weapons programs. The Soviet Union helped China with its nuclear program. The Chinese helped Pakistan with their nuclear program. And the Pakistanis, once they had a nuclear capability, looked for countries that they had strategic relationships or wanted to strengthen their strategic relationships and said, look, we have the ultimate weapon. Here is proof of our commitment to you. We will share this with you. So it's not new in the behavior of nuclear weapon states to do this kind of thing.
David Albright, can you put what is going on with the whole AQ Khan network in the context of the latest headlines, which is the U.S. putting pressure on Iran?
Without Khan's help, we probably wouldn't be having this crisis with Iran now. I mean, Iranian scientists and technicians are capable, but they wouldn't have been able to pull together a centrifuge program on their own, and Khan's assistance was vital, along with the assistance from certain European companies that were associated or were working with Khan. And so I think that we're facing this crisis now with Iran, and largely because Khan and his associates helped Iran put together a gas centrifuge program.
I want to go back to Hans-Jörg Mark Wiedmer, spokesperson for the Swiss Attorney General. What are you demanding now of the U.S. government?
Well, as it is an ongoing criminal investigation, I couldn't go into the details of this criminal investigation. One of the goals of the investigation is to determine the role that the people involved in our investigation played. And as it shows, and as I heard in the declarations of the other people on the network right now, it's really an international task to look into these details. These are international matters. I also think that the threat that comes out of nuclear proliferation is not a threat that concerns only one nation. Not only Switzerland, not only the United States, it's a world political problem. And I think that the cooperation will be necessary. I think that the information that the United States authorities can provide us with can help us to determine the role of the people in our investigation. But also, you know, we've been cooperating with other countries so far. This investigation has a big importance in Switzerland. We are into looking into any implication of the people here, and also we want to put them on trial and let a judge decide what has been done, what's punishable under Swiss laws. And by doing so, I think we are contributing also to the safety of the people, not only in Switzerland or the United States, but worldwide.
And you, your reaction to David Albright's speculation around the issue of these men, the father and two sons, the Tinners, being involved with the CIA, which is why the U.S. government is protecting them.
Well, first of all, I couldn't really hear the declaration of Mr. Albright due to technical problems on the telephone line, but that's not a problem by itself because I couldn't comment on that. The only thing I can say, it's a criminal investigation here. We are into prosecution, intelligence, or also speculation about any intelligence involvement doesn't play any role in our criminal investigation. We are not the authority to look into this. So this is purely a criminal investigation. We want to, there is probable cause for criminal actions. We are looking into that. We want to try to establish a case to bring charges to the people involved and to let a judge or a tribunal in Switzerland decide if criminal actions have been done by these people with implications not only for Switzerland but worldwide.
Hans-Jürg Mark Wiedmer, I want to thank you very much for being with us, spokesperson for the Swiss Attorney General, Professor Xia Min at Princeton University, nuclear physicist with the Center for Science and Global Security, and David Albright, former UN weapons inspector. I want to thank you all for being with us. As we turn now to a related issue, Juan?
Yes, on Thursday, former UN chief weapons inspector Hans Blix called for a permanent worldwide ban on nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons. The recommendation is the central finding of a major report issued Thursday by the Independent Weapons of Mass Destruction Commission, which was headed by Blix. The commission concluded that, quote, there has been a serious and dangerous loss of momentum and direction in disarmament and nonproliferation efforts.
Hans Blix also cautioned the United States against attacking Iran and North Korea, and he estimated Israel has a total of 200 nuclear weapons, even though the country has never acknowledged it, even has a nuclear weapons program. At a news conference at the United Nations, Blix said it's too dangerous for any country to have nuclear weapons.
American Rifles Association says that weapons are not dangerous in themselves, only the people who hold the weapons. And I can see a sort of echo of that in the view also of the nuclear weapons, that the weapons, nuclear weapons, are not dangerous per se, only depending on who has them. Now, the Commission does not accept that argument. We say that, yes, governments, individuals can be more or less reckless in this world, but the weapons per se are dangerous anywhere, anytime. If you look at the U.S., there are lots of weapons on hair trigger alert, and the same applies to Russia. They are dangerous anywhere where they are. And if you say that, well, let's simply look at the actors who has them. Well, sadly, actors change also. Governments change in different countries. You may be satisfied and say that these are very responsible people, they won't do anything. But the next day, that government may be overthrown. They may have another one. So the view of the Commission, now speaking with them, they say that these weapons are dangerous in anybody's hands. That doesn't exclude that there are some could be more reckless than others.
Hans Blix also called on Iran to stop its uranium enrichment program, but he acknowledged it's understandable why Iran would feel threatened by the United States. He recalled the U.S.-led coup that overthrew the democratically elected government of Iranian Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh in 1953.
We think Iran is described as a threat, and their enrichment of uranium is described as a threat to the whole world. And the Commission is also the view that it would be desirable that Iran refrain from going on with enrichment of uranium. But one must also try, if you want a solution for this, to see, look at the issue from the side of the Iranians. They see 130,000 American soldiers in Iraq, and they see American bases in Pakistan and in Afghanistan, and the more American military activities to the north of them. They remember that Mossadegh, who was elected premier, was ousted with subversive methods from the outside. So it is not inconceivable that some groups in Iran may feel that the security is being threatened from the outside.
Hans Blix also criticized the Bush administration for ignoring the findings of UN weapons inspectors ahead of the Iraq war.
The conclusion I draw is that for the future, it is desirable to rely upon international inspection, professional international inspection, and also to make use of national intelligence. I'm not against it. But national intelligence must not remote control international verification. They must give them tips, because they have means which the international inspection does not have. They have the means of listening, they have the satellites, they have the spies, etc. International inspection does not operate with that. But the international inspection has the possibility of going into the sites, into the buildings, and to demand, we want to see this, we want to want that. These are things that governments cannot use. So a combination of this is desirable for the future. That's one principal lesson I draw from the case of Iran.
Former Chief UN Weapons Inspector Hans Blix. To discuss his remarks and the report from the Independent Weapons of Mass Destruction Commission, we're joined by John Burroughs. He's Executive Director of the Lawyers Committee on Nuclear Policy. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Response, and how important is what Hans Blix has to say?
It's extremely important. The commission basically is saying that the focus has been on proliferation for the past decade or so, and it's time to start putting the focus back on elimination of the weapons worldwide, whether they be in Pakistan or the United States. The commission says there have been three waves of proliferation. Proliferation began at 1942 in Los Alamos. There were the five weapon states to begin with, the United States, Russia, Britain, China, France. Then came India, Pakistan, Israel. That's the second wave. Then the third wave was Iraq, weapons program reversed, Libya, weapons program reversed, North Korea probably has nuclear weapons, Iran might or might not, might be seeking to have a weapons capability. So the commission is saying we're facing this problem of proliferation, but it really goes back to the very beginning, and therefore proliferation has to be reversed where it began, and that's the United States.
And the commission is also critical of the new United States role in terms of taking more unilateral actions as opposed to in terms of participation in international treaties around nuclear weapons, no?
Absolutely. In the mid-1990s, there was a surge of multilateralism. The Non-Proliferation Treaty was made permanent. The Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty was negotiated. But then things started sliding backwards. In 1999, the U.S. Senate rejected the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, refused to approve it for ratification. 2002, the Bush administration withdrew from the ABM Treaty. Then the Bush administration negotiated a treaty with Moscow, which wasn't really a treaty. It didn't have any verification of the reductions. So the Blix Commission is saying it is time to return to the multilateralism that was tried in the 90s.
And John Burroughs, how significant is it that Hans Blix named Israel as a nuclear power?
It's not particularly significant because it's well known that Israel is a nuclear power. But there was a lot of the Blix Commission report is basically taking things that have been said for a long time and saying we should still do these things that we were talking about a long time ago. But one new thing was the Blix Commission said there should be steps taken towards a weapons of mass destruction free zone in the Middle East. And one place to start would be with a freeze on production of nuclear fuel that can be used in reactors or in bombs, both in Iran but also in Israel. So I thought that was a useful suggestion.
And finally, you're talking about the Bush administration, the history, but you also look at Clinton's involvement in escalation.
In 1994, Clinton had been in office for 2 years. The United States adopted a nuclear posture review, which reaffirmed Cold War policy. That sort of set the template for what was going to unfold in the years to come, the lack of reductions, the rejection, the eventual rejection of the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. It was also in the 1990s that the United States began to talk about using nuclear weapons to respond to biological or chemical weapons threats or attacks. So a lot of what we're seeing during the Bush administration was set in motion during the Clinton administration.
And this commission, the actual formation of the commission, what were the forces that brought it about?
In 2000, the Non-Proliferation Treaty agreed to a program of action that would have led to a nuclear weapon-free world. The United States agreed to that. That was during the Clinton administration. But it became readily apparent soon that that program wasn't going to be carried out. So then the Swedish government formed this commission to at least form a parallel track to talk about the proposals and the needs.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, John Burroughs, Executive Director of the Lawyers Committee on Nuclear Policy.
Glad to be here.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. When we come back, an expose on housing conducted by, well, Democracy Now! Co-host and Daily News reporter Juan Gonzalez. Stay with us.
That's great. It starts with an earthquake, birds and snakes, an airplane. Lenny Bruce is not afraid. Listen to yourself, churn world, serve its own needs. Dummy, serve your own needs. Beat it up, an ox beat, grunt, no strength. The ladder starts to clatter with fear, fight down high. Wire and a fire represented seven games in a government for hire and a combat site. Left to us are coming in a hurry with the furies breathing down your neck. Team, my team, reporters, babble, Trump, tethered crop. Look at that, no pain, fine, then. Uh-oh, overflow, population, common poop, but it'll do. Save yourself, serve yourself, world, serve its own needs. Listen to your heartbeat. Slice and burn, return, listen to yourself, churn. Locking in, uniform and book, burning blood, letting every motive escalate. Automotive, centering, light a candle, light a motor, step down, watching heel crush, crush. Uh-oh, this means no fear, cavalier, renegade, steer clear. A tournament of lies. Offer me solutions, offer me a...
REM, it's the end of the world as we know it. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we turn now to look at the issue of gentrification, how it's playing out in New York City. One of the biggest owners of rent-stabilized apartments here in New York is the Pinnacle Group. It's carrying out an aggressive campaign to chase out many of its low-income and elderly tenants living in Harlem, the South Bronx, Queens, and Brooklyn. Juan Gonzalez has been reporting on this for the New York Daily News for the past month. We are also joined in the studio by attorney Kim Powell, who's head of the Buyers and Renters United to Save Harlem, or BRUSH. We did ask a representative from the Pinnacle Group to be on the program, but they declined our invitation. Juan, why don't you lay out the series of groundbreaking stories that you've been doing that could well lead to some indictments?
Yes, well, I've written now seven columns in the past month, all detailing the practices of this group called the Pinnacle Group, which largely unknown real estate company for in the city, but which has mushroomed in the last few years to now own 20,000 rent-stabilized units. Remarkably, I found out that in the last 2 years, they've tried to evict a quarter of all of their tenants, 5,000 eviction proceedings in the housing courts, of the various housing courts in the boroughs of New York. They are systematically, apparently, trying to force out as many people as possible to take advantage of rent stabilization laws that allow them to sharply to double or triple the rents. So an apartment that was once renting for $500 a month is suddenly, you know, they get the old tenant out, they bring in, they do some quick remodeling of the apartment, and suddenly it's $1,500 a month or $1,700 a month. And they've been doing it throughout the city, largely unnoticed. And one of the things that I began to uncover is that a lot of these rent increases are based apparently on fraudulent work, that invoices that, for instance, I found in one apartment, they claimed they spent $1,000 on 100 gallons of paint to paint one apartment. Anybody who's painted an apartment in their lives knows you don't need that much paint. You could paint a whole building for 100 gallons of paint. There were all kinds of situations where the actual documents that they submitted to state agencies are highly questionable and maybe actually fraudulent. But then there's the stories of all of these elderly, mostly senior citizens, disabled people,
immigrants who are being dragged through the courts, many of them on bogus charges, just to see if they can be forced out, just to see if they won't be able to withstand going. I had a 75-year-old woman who's been to court now in the last 2 years over two dozen times with Pinnacle trying to get her out of her apartment. And in the process, of course, I met Kim Powell and their group, which has been formed predominantly to fight Pinnacle. And Kim, maybe you'd like to tell us how you got involved and how you began to realize that this Pinnacle thing was a huge problem across the city.
Sure. Pinnacle Management had actually been the owner of a few buildings along the west corridors of upper Manhattan. And with that having been said, roughly around June of last year, they began about the process of attempting to convert two or three of the buildings just along Riverside Drive. So with that information
in mind... When you say convert, to convert them to condos.
To condominium conversion. Right. They filed what was called a red herring with the Attorney General's office. Once that occurred, once that information was given to the tenants, it was the responsibility of myself and another of the tenants in the neighborhood to go about the business of making inquiries as to exactly how many buildings would be affected by this condo conversion. Of late, we know that there are seven buildings in which he's filed the condominium conversion. One of the things that was frightening with the condominium conversion is that what it said on two levels was that the asking prices were not commensurate with the housing stock or the per capita income in the neighborhood any more than the quality and conditions of these buildings were commensurate with the asking price. The median asking price was between, in an as-is condition, the insider's price is it stands somewhere between $800,000 and $1 million per unit.
I wanted to turn to a meeting that took place. On May 15th, three local community boards held a hearing where tenants testified about their treatment from Pinnacle after the company bought their building.
I live at 680 Riverside Drive. That is at the exact corner of 145th Street. 2 years ago, there was a fire during Father's Day. Okay? As of today, there are still several outstanding violations on the building. The building is in the middle of a condo conversion. My concern is that that there were several tenants who were offered buyouts to give up their apartment for this condo conversion. My concern is the outstanding violations for those of us who choose not to move and or buy the apartments because of the exorbitant prices for the condo conversion.
Regarding illegal evictions, we had one family on the third floor in our building where the mother went out to pick up the daughter from school. When she came back, the marshals were there. They evicted her. The family had to stay with one of the neighbors in our building. It took them almost 3 weeks. Pinnacle claimed that they owed 3 months in, you know, back rent or what have you.
The building is at 964 Amsterdam Avenue, and it went up in flames 1 week after Joel Wiener took it over from Baruch Singer, and it has not appeared in one article with the exception of the New York Times, and it went up in flames, killing two of our neighbors, two of the sweetest people I ever knew, and it is as though it has not happened. 22 firefighters were injured, numerous tenants suffered burns, household pets were killed. And we are still locked out of that building, and Mr. Wiener is using every tactic in the book to stall and delay, even as there's a court order saying the building must be completed and repaired by June 30th, and the contractor has just told us they are not going to meet that deadline.
My name is Bobby Jones, and since 1967, my family and I have occupied an apartment, Dunbar Apartments. In the last 8 months, we've had to go to court six times to respond to charges by the current owner and the previous owner. By the grace of God, I'm happy to say that each time we were victorious. In the last court proceedings, not only was I given an abatement, but I was also given an order by these two separate judges to force Pinnacle to give me keys after they had changed the locks on the entrance to my door. And more so than anything else, I have a message for Pinnacle. I've been here since 1967. I've seen seven different owners. I've gone to court numerous of times. And like most people who spoke before me, I am not afraid. I will not leave. You cannot make me. I am not going.
New York tenants testifying against Pinnacle at a community board hearing. New York Democratic Congressmember Charlie Rangel was also in attendance. He blasted what he called a conspiracy to gentrify the community.
And what you are doing is stopping even a broader conspiracy to take our community away from us. This is not just coming from Pinnacle, but throughout our borough, we have similar schemes where speculators and landlords have acquired large amounts of property and found loopholes in the state law that would allow them to move in an aggressive way to remove tenants either through legal means or through harassment. And once they leave, the apartments are redone, and the type of rents that are being asked for or demanded are absolutely ridiculous.
New York Congressmember Charles Rangel. Juan, you were also at this meeting. Why is this a national story?
Well, I think what it is, first of all, it would be a national story in its own when you have thousands of people suddenly being forced out of their homes in New York. And despite all the press that we have in the city, nobody has been covering this. But I think that there is a national significance to what is going on. And it's a theory of mine that I've been developing now as I report on and analyze the situation in urban America, is that increasingly, especially now that we've reached a peak oil crisis, there is a concerted move to move with the middle class and the upper classes that moved out to the suburbs back in the 60s and the 50s and the 70s back into the cities. There are many people who are living in the exurbs who don't want to have to drive 1.5 hours to work every day in the city and now to spend so much more money on gas. And so that real estate speculators...
And also older people.
And older people as well. And so what's happening is real estate speculators are realizing that the market is ripe to re-grab the inner cities and to, in essence, create urban Americas more in the European models, where the middle and the upper classes live in the central cities and the poor live in the suburbs. And on the Parisian model, for instance, the immigrants and the poor in Paris live in the suburbs, not in the city. And our cities developed throughout the 50s and 60s was basically the central cities being the place where the poor lived. So now there is a concerted effort to recapture the cities and to displace and to move out the residents that are there. And why so many of the black and Latino political officials are now getting up in arms over this is because they also realize it has political significance in terms of their political bases are now being dramatically changed as more and more upper income people and upper middle class people are now replacing their original constituents. So I think that and the problem is that government policy, rather than try to assure affordable housing and a good mix of poor, working class, and upper class within urban America, the policies that local governments are pursuing now are really to assist these landlords and developers in pushing people out and driving up prices. So I think that I do not believe that what's happening in New York City is an isolated situation. I actually believe it's happening, and I've been receiving emails from people in other parts of the country, in Chicago and other places, in the south side of Chicago and others, that the same thing is happening.
Well, Juan, we're going to link to all of your stories at democracynow.org. And Kim Powell of Brush, living in one of the Pinnacle buildings, we thank you very much for being with us as we wrap up today's program. Tomorrow I'll be at New York Ethical Culture Society. In the morning we'll be talking about Iraq. In the afternoon at 2 o'clock, Noam Chomsky will be there. Tuesday night, 92nd Street Y with Helen Thomas. Sunday night with Harry Belafonte and Danny Glover at St. John the Divine. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez, our website, democracynow.org. Thanks for joining us.